Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are recording this on Election Day 2020. So this is a big day. We are anticipating what happens in the coming days and weeks and months. But today we wanted to talk a little bit about, well, before we get started, a shout and a prayer. We got one more episode coming with our homies over at the Brown Liquor Report. And that episode is going to be, we're going to record that at the end of this week. Mm-hmm. So this is, that'll be after the election. And we'll have a lot to talk about then. But we had the one episode and then we'll have a post-election episode. So stay tuned for a shot and a prayer. Go follow the Brown Liquor Report.
Check them out. Yes, we appreciate it.
Thanks for rocking with us. So today we're talking about the power of story. This is an important concept for us because everyone is living in their own story and everyone is the hero of their own story. In every story, there's always a hero and a villain, and the hero must progress and grow. And sometimes the best villains do the same. So we're talking a little bit about that today and how that applies, I guess, as we read the Bible and in our lives.
Absolutely. Usually the hero and the villain in any story is determined not so much by how it's laid out, but how we perceive those characters. So I think it's important to make sure that we understand how stories are crafted to support, lift up, celebrate certain entities and to almost villainize, if not dehumanize or deflate other entities. So we're just going to look at that through a semi-theological lens because I think it has importance even in your regular life, your secular life. So here we go.
Most heroes have a hero's journey. This is a common literary device, and there's 12 steps to it. I'm not going to go through the whole, all of the steps, but if we take, for example, the Exodus story in the Bible, there's a hero's journey where Moses receives that call to adventure from the Lord. He refuses the call. That's another part of the journey. Mm-hmm. Once he actually proceeds on that call, that crossing that first threshold is another step where Moses goes to Pharaoh and he tells them to let the Hebrews go. He tells the Egyptians to let the heroes go. Then there's a test, and that test is the plagues and the escape. Then there's this moment where you approach, it's called the approach to the inmost cave, which is where the hero really goes and does some introspection and things look pretty dim.
Okay.
And so that's at the Red Sea. Then there's this ordeal that follows, which is when they're in the wilderness. Eventually, there's a reward, and that's when they discover that land. And then for Israel, the road back is when they go into exile after they had been in the land. And then there's a resurrection, which is the resurrection of the hero, which is the return after the exile. And then the final step is return with elixir. And that is when Israel is stronger, they're not bound by geography, and they're free mm-hmm. to spread out, and God is with them. And so that's kind of how a hero's journey works in all stories. I mean, you can recognize this in every hero story. And so it works in the Bible. You can see it. It works in our lives. And so that's kind of like the common mm-hmm. trope and framework that you should really recognize as you're evaluating your life and reading literature and everything else.
Yes.
We did an episode called, I think it was The Power of Myth, where we talked about the creation myths and the purpose for that. So we're not going to rehash that, but the myths mm-hmm. in the Bible, Genesis 1-11, that's the section of myths. And they're not considered false or fairy tales. They just provide a framework for the way of understanding the world. After that, Genesis 12-50, those are the sagas. And the sagas are these big dramatic stories where there's this heroic adventure. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of those is to describe Israel's formation in the Bible. Interesting about the sagas, like archaeologically, we don't have any evidence of anyone before David in the Bible. So the ground shows us, you know, what actually happened. So it doesn't mean that the people who came before didn't exist, but we have to be conscious of the way that they tell those stories. Those stories are not told for historicity. They're told to explain how Israel got to the point that they are, how they formed and things like that. And those sagas work that way. And you can see, if you start to use this lens as you read the Bible, you can see how these follow heroic tropes and different things. So like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, their whole story arc, it shows how Israel came to be and ending in Jacob, where Jacob changes his name to Israel to be, I guess, a proxy for the nation. And so these stories have a function. It's not that they are false and they should be looked at as just stories that we tell. They're stories told for a reason.
Right. So we know that stories are used because they convey much more information, and it gives everyone a common literature almost to look to. So it creates community. So stories, more so than just a freestanding verse, can explain how something came to be. And I know that, like, people are familiar with this when sermonizing. There's so much more power in telling the background, the setting, the other characters, the, you know, what was going on as the main character in whatever scripture or within whatever saga was coming to be or facing his challenge. So we have these stories. Most societies have these stories because it gives their people something common to look at as far as rooting. You know, where did it all come from? Or where did we answer the major question of how we came to be? So that's the arc that we're looking at.
And so, based on what you're saying, it's important for us to realize that we know things because of the stories that we tell. We don't live in all of the events. And so the only way we communicate what we know to future generations is either through story, through writing down facts and things like that. And so it's important for us to tell stories, tell the right stories, so that the people who need to know what happened before them can recognize and know how to keep moving.
Absolutely.
Now, in terms of the utility of story, in the Bible, you'll notice a lot. You won't notice a lot where they say things like this verse says. They'll quote verses, but it wasn't really structured that way back then. They just had the scriptures. But if you look at Jesus, he didn't always say Isaiah says this. Occasionally that would happen, but most likely he would tell a story because the story conveys more information. So like if I were to say Isaiah 38:4 says, and then whatever it says, you have to listen to everything that I'm going to say to even know what I'm talking about. But if I say it in the story of Jonah, I've immediately communicated a lot of information in those five words before I even started saying anything, so that you're caught up. And so story has this ability to convey lots of information in a little bit of minimal space. And it's something that we can carry and remember. And so that's part of the power of the medium. Now, for conveying theological truths, and I want to step away from the Bible for this. Like, people could read theological books, and they write tons of them. And people like me will read them, but most people won't. And so there are other ways to do this. And so Octavia Butler in The Parable of the Sower, she did this in a beautiful way. It's amazing. It was a prophetic book. So she wrote it in 1993, and it takes place in 2024, which is 4 years from now, this recording. And in this book, there was disease. It was this huge income gap. Poverty was running wild. Streets, there were drugs on the streets. Climate change was an issue. Then they had this strong guy leader who was concerned more with these impactful slogans than he was with the leadership.
Sounds familiar.
2024, 4 years from now. So that is pretty dead on. But in this book, her father was this Baptist minister. And she grew up, Lauren is the main character. And she grew up in the church. But then she started to think differently about it. And she started writing these letters. And she comes up with this religion called Earthseed. And so the book starts out, and it quotes throughout the book, "All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change." And this is one of the scriptures, the Earth Seed scriptures. And so throughout the book, she has all of these scriptures and sayings. But in The Parable of the Sower, Butler has Lauren writing that the God is change. And those who respond positively to God or change are those who succeed. And she tells this in a story about what's going on in Lauren's life and what's going on in the world. And Lauren's writing these things as they apply to the world that she's living.
But the
story is how you convey the truth. And a lot more people have read Parable of the Sower than James Cone. So it's the story has the power to move. And I think it is important for us to recognize and leverage that as we explore our own faith and in our own life. The important thing about Lauren's theology is that it doesn't focus on gods at all. It focuses on the reality and the impact on each other. And so Earthseed is a way for us to be aware of how we interact with God, how our interactions affect God, and how God continues to affect us as we affect each other. It's a beautiful religion.
That's what it looks like. Those of us who have found ourselves on these journeys where we're taking what we've been taught and we're looking for a deeper connection we want to hash out and search out and interrogate what things mean and making sure that we're stripping away those things that are not helpful. So the metaphor for being able to adapt to change that, you know, God is going to bring you up and through these change processes and how you handle that, how you adapt to that, how you're agile through those gauntlets will determine, you know, like we said, if you succeed. That's kind of what that journey looks like. You know, even when we were going back over our seasons and we were just talking about where we were with deconstructing and reconstructing our faith walks, this is what it was. It's the adaptation and the agility that we've been able to show that continues to develop the overall relationship. So what Octavia Butler shared with us is not really any different, but she has daughters. So she has literary daughters such as Alice Walker who pick up this mantle of telling these stories, ultimately telling stories about faith and about rooting and about how deep your roots keep you from breaking. You might bend, but you don't break. That is a theme that's, you know, found throughout Alice Walker's writing. So everybody's familiar, or at least we say everybody, is familiar with The Color Purple. A lot more people have experienced The Color Purple as a movie, but even in the book, she takes time to actually, almost like Zora Neale Hurston did, give back the gift of your divinity to your womanhood or to your blackness. And what does that mean when you're in the center of your own faith experience? What does it mean when everybody that God sends to help you, not necessarily harm you, but sends to reflect who he is and reflect the phases of relationship. What happens when all of those people look like you, live like you, act like you, interact with you? So Color Purple is a beautiful story about Black women who do the emotional labor on behalf of one another, you know, to set themselves free. At least this is how I saw it. This is how I experienced it. So in that story, you have characters, you have Celie and Nettie, who are the sisters who have both been abused. But Celie is the main character in the movie, was played by Whoopi Goldberg. But she is the one who experiences a great breaking in her faith and a lot of abuse from men and women in her life. But then there are key characters who help her redefine who God is and how he has shown his grace in her life. One of them is her sister, Nettie. The other one is Shug Avery. So Shug Avery being a former lover and confidant of Celie's husband, if you want to call him that, mister. She enters her life as this woman that is so different from anything that she has personally experienced. And she also enters her life as this woman carrying all of these stereotypes and social weight of what it meant to be free. You know, in the early 20th century, let's say anywhere between 1910 and 1925. And what Shug Avery does is kind of what I feel like I've experienced, where it's the people who do not represent what you think is traditional, who are able to articulate through story, through their experience, their very, you know, out of the box experience, just how big and how far reaching the God of our faith can really be, how he, you know, we say he can reach you anywhere, but if we don't articulate, you know, the cracks and crevices that life can put you in, it's hard to imagine what that looks like. So Shug Avery is this woman of the world who over time, especially, and I think you do see this in the movie, you realize that she's coming full circle. The world put her in a crack in a crevice and redefined her as someone that was unreachable. She was only going to be reached by carnal pleasures, or reached by vices. The way that the movie unravels her character is that her rooting is so deep in her faith that life kind of swayed her. Mm-hmm. It bent her, but it did not break her. And that's why that final scene in the movie is so, well, to me, very, very touching, where she came all the way full circle, singing back to her father who shepherded her faith, but also at the same time attempted to disconnect her from the fullness of her expression as a woman who believed in God. He was not successful. Her coming back and singing her way, not only back into the church and back into his view, but also just demonstrating that we take this long, circuitous route through life and we find out that those things that we were taught in the beginning are true. That is what she demonstrated through her life walk.
Yeah, and so especially the text of The Color Purple, the book, Alice Walker intended to be a theological inquiry. It didn't. All of that didn't make it into the movie. Some of it did, like when you're sitting in the field or something like that. But Shug Avery serves as in Celie's hero story. Shug Avery serves as that mentor who walks her through that, like you said. So Shug says, "God is inside you and inside everyone else. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it find it. And so throughout the book, Suge is saying all of these things. And then you get to, I believe God is everything, everything that is or ever was or ever will be. And so when Suge says it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it, when she says that, which is where you get the title of the movie from, Suge is this panentheist that sees God in all of it. And so that's the chief theological question of the work. It's like, God is in all of this. You have the audacity to walk by God and not notice. And so she's teaching Celia that she has to train herself to see God in all of it. And so this is another form of story that's conveying this deep theological richness. Uh-huh. And this is how it's so effective. Another way, I mean, it's not just in books, it's also in film. We just watched Lovecraft Country, which is a hugely theological work. The theology in Lovecraft Country is based on the Christological model, where Tick is that Christ figure. And I'm not going to spoil it too much, but that's kind of, if you watch that and get to the end of season one, it's mm-hmm. so impossible not to see that they're doing a faith treatment of that. And it's not just faith, because it's heavily influenced by African traditional religions. It's making many theological statements at one point. The other one is the movie Coco was also another way to do this. So for kids, I love this movie because it goes through the Day of the Dead, and
it's so emotional.
It's amazing that and exposes people who haven't even considered these things to all these concepts. And that's what the characters in the movie do. Miguel hasn't been mm-hmm. Exposed to that part of his culture. They have this festival, the Day of the Dead, but what it means and why it's important, he doesn't learn until he actually travels to that realm. And so it's a story of discovery of how our histories have been obscured. And that he gets to see why it's important, why his ancestors are important, why they had this altar, why it's a beautiful theological tale of cultural appreciation. And so you can find theological richness in all of these stories as the hero progresses. It's there for you to enjoy. So let's talk a bit about how, you know, yeah, you can tell the story, but then what happens when the story is not really told correctly?
Exactly. So there is telling the wrong stories. There's a quote that says, it's a great African proverb that says, until the lions have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. So that is important, because when you find yourself disconnected forcibly or just by circumstances from your ability to tell your stories across generations, there presents an opportunity for the details and the circumstances to be manipulated to glorify, you know, one entity or one side or one character over the other. So when we talk about stories that that I don't want to say not helpful, but stories that we know have a slant to them, stories that we know are told in a certain way to convey a certain idea, and how those ideas can be harmful if unchecked, we're talking about these things where the hunters get to talk about their hunt and the lions don't have an opportunity to discuss the event from their perspective. So one story such like that is the whole story surrounding the discovery of the New World, the discovery of America, the establishment of European settlements in the New World. And we tell these stories under the auspices usually of Christopher Columbus. So Christopher Columbus, depending on who's writing, sounds like an adventurer. He sounds like an innovator. He sounds like a conqueror, like a hero figure, as if he was victorious in some sort of fight or some sort of conflict, and he came out on top. But when the other characters who have circumstances shared with Christopher Columbus begin to tell their story compared to what has been prepared for him, you realize that there are some divergences that are supported with fact from the lion side. You see what I mean? So like when the indigenous began to tell their stories of what it meant to be invaded, not necessarily a Eurocentric story of what it meant to discover, Christopher Columbus looks different. His impact is understood differently. Other characteristics come out that don't necessarily match conqueror, victorious person, pious person, humble. These things don't show if I begin to tell the story, let's say from the perspective of someone who was already living in lands that someone claims to discover, who already had a society in lands that someone claims to have civilized, someone who already, you know, had a social hierarchy and a history prior to someone saying, you just began when I began to view you. So that's one of the largest things about Christopher Columbus. Same thing goes with Manifest Destiny, this idea that God wants a certain group of people to conquer, vilify, and annihilate a whole nother group of people as it is playing out, you know, in a modern time. So Manifest Destiny is the idea that helped grow the United States from one ocean to the other. And that is a very clean and tight sentence that does away with all of the details, all of the nuances, and all of the sub-conflicts that ultimately allowed that to happen. And we still deal with the fact that that narrative doesn't match the actual events that took place that secured the country from one ocean to the other.
That's so important. Like that's huge. Which when the story is told from the perspective of the hunter, you have to be intellectually curious about. Mm-hmm. So we started talking about the way Exodus story conveys theological truth. But when you get to that part where they get to the land, who's mm-hmm. the invading army? It's the hunter. It's not the lion, Canaan. It's the hunter. When we tell a story about David and Goliath, and David is told as the hero, do we ask ourselves, well, mm-hmm. who is the invading force? Like, what's happening here? And so, yeah,
absolutely.
Be aware of, we should be asking ourselves, who's telling the story? Who's in position to actually shape this? So, yeah, that's an amazing point for how we interpret.
Absolutely. And something else that, you know, that I feel like people are contending with now is rooted religion. You know, anything that is not mainstream Christianity, and how we continue to investigate, interrogate, and define those things, we are shedding a lot of the colonization and the demonization of those practices and those entities that were not celebrated within this mainstream, mainline type of Christianity. So, you know, under the umbrella of voodoo stories, we're told that voodoo are these occult practices, and, you know, that are extraneous to religion. But we're not really told that this is something that is completely enmeshed within a Christian expression, and that it is something that kind of said, bring all of you into the room. So what we now know as an occult practice, it didn't require you to leave your blackness at the door. It didn't require you to leave your critical thinking skills at the door. It didn't require you to shed your femininity to really, or your sensuality or your sexuality, to practice, to be able to worship God in a way that made sense to you culturally. And we're beginning to redefine those things, because ultimately we begin to see Christianity as conqueror. And if Christianity is used by anybody, any entity that finds itself in power to conquer, to crush, to silence, well, then you have to wonder, what is the motivating factor behind you saying that I cannot express my love for God or my understanding of who God is and how he moves in our lives in this way? 9 times out of 10, that investigation and that interrogation, you're going to find that the cutoff from those practices was championed from a mainstream culture standpoint, as in, you need to assimilate into this and leave all of your nuances and all of your unique practices alone, and you need to assimilate into this larger system. That hasn't worked for everybody, because again, that is the hunter deciding for me that his way is the best way. That is not always true.
Yeah. Right. And as we mentioned before many times, and we will continue to do so because the other side has been mentioned an equal number of times, the occult that voodoo is labeled as is not different from Christianity. Occult means that there's supernatural practices. Christianity right. has those. There's mystical elements. Christianity has those. There's magical beliefs. Christianity has those. And so to label one occult, you have to turn the lens on the other and say, well, you're doing the same thing over there.
Mm-hmm.
So why am I different? It's different because I'm doing it. I control it and you don't. And so that's the power of who's telling the story. It's you have the power to dictate it, but then other people do have the power to tell a different story. And so that's when I want mm-hmm. to talk about this element in a story, the turn or the climax, where things seem hopeless and you don't know how you're gonna get through this, mm-hmm. but you have the power to turn those wrong stories into right stories. We can see that in kind of what we've been going through for the past 4 years, culminating in this election. There's been a lot of hope that has been lost throughout this process. Mm-hmm. You start out with a inauguration speech, an American carnage, and then you go into the Muslim ban, and then you go into children being separated at the border, and you go into all of these events, the criminality that's surrounding this office, the impeachment that doesn't seem to go anywhere, the death of mm-hmm. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the rushing through of another Supreme Court justice, and the handling of mishandling of a global pandemic.
Mm-hmm. So many wrong things.
There's a lot of places where you could lose hope. Yeah, and that's a short list. So yes. The thing is, like, we're at the turn. We're at
absolutely
any election. By the time you're listening to the election, will have occurred, and we'll still be counting. But it's important for us to know that in that turn, where it's most probable that we will lose our hope, that we can look at, wait, who's telling this story?
Absolutely. So this becomes very important because, like, even though the election would have passed by the time people hear this, what is going to remain is the fight for the narrative, the fight for whose narrative sounds the best. And this is where I would encourage people to be honest and to be truthful about the path that they are on, the life that they live, and the world that they occupy, because these are the things that make our stories very different. And like we say, we're attempting to revise a wrong story. That revision sometimes looks like some of the behavior and displays that we've seen over the same amount of time. Let's look at the last 4 years. So sometimes writing a wrong story, you have to control your narrative, because people want to redefine you for their purposes. For instance, some people are writing a wrong story in a way that causes them to go to the streets to chant things and to find solidarity with their community members who say, yes, here's a place, here is a circumstance, here is a detail that we want to put a period here and start a new sentence. That is how you do it. So it's not so much that you erase, it's that you take what's there and then you start creating new situations, new facts, new events, new literature that begins to take the story in another direction. So we have to be, you know, just like what we say, just like what we highlighted earlier about Alice Walker saying, your job is to train yourself to see God in everything. Some of us are training ourselves to see where the opportunity is to begin to right the wrong, to change the story, to tell the story more accurately from the viewpoint of the people who are most impacted by that story or most impacted by those characters. All of that is important.
So I shared with you earlier this week, my cousin, her child is in a school system, mm-hmm. and she was looking at her social studies lesson, and they were talking about indentured servants in America in the 1600s. And yep. they showed these Black people as indentured servants, and they talked about they were treated poorly and they had to do extra chores and things like that. And that was supposed to be their take on slavery. And that's what people were doing. And so my cousin was so incensed by this that she mm-hmm. wrote a letter to the principal and copied the Board of Education, the Director of Diversity and Inclusion, and pretty much everyone that is voted into office in that county. Mm-hmm. And within 30 minutes, she got a call from the principal. The principal's saying, like, her phone had been ringing off the hook for 3 minutes after she received that email from everyone who CC'd on the email. And so what they're going to do is form this committee to reevaluate the curriculum. And they want
right.
Parents and people in that county that are not on that board or employed by that county to participate in that. And so my cousin could be expecting to receive a call. But that is the power of affecting those wrong stories. Like mm-hmm. you see the story, you recognize what it is, but then we have to do something, because the power of the story is in the telling. Without telling a story, it has no meaning. It won't be remembered and it have no impact at all. And so we have the power to reshape the wrong stories that have been told about us as people, about us in our faith, about our traditional faith, about who we are now and who we can be. Mm-hmm. We can write those stories. Mm-hmm. We are revealing the truth about the treatment of Black and Indigenous peoples.
Absolutely. Truth and it's about, uncomfortable.
Right. It's uncomfortable. It's, mm-hmm. it's uncomfortable. It's about who we are, who we love, the truth about who we are as a country and who we want to be. And in that story, we build a community. And that is where the story matters, because no one tells a story to no one. Tell a story to other people in your community. They believe the story. And mm-hmm. then they tell the story to other people. And it is through the telling of the story that the community is built up, that the community has a center, and they're knit together by those stories.
Absolutely. I just made this point. I just made this point this morning with a friend that we've had. Our community was so reliant upon passing information through oral storytelling because of, you know, literacy gaps, schooling gaps. You couldn't always trust that we would, you know, have a written record of things that people needed to know, our families needed to know into the generations. And we are again at that point where we are recognizing that as we uncover and reveal the truth about who we really are, it our ability to tell the story, to convey these ideas, these facts, these new circumstances into the generations has become so much more important. We haven't been recording regularly throughout the pandemic, but one thing that has, you know, even happened in my life is that I have been able to be in the company of my grandmother, who is in her 90s. And for all of her, you know, health issues and just what it means to watch her aging, you know, in her home and just having the privilege and the honor to care for her, the biggest benefit that I've had is the same benefit that I've had that I had when I was a child, which was being able to listen to her and hear her stories and hear her interpretation of her own life. That has been huge because she is equipping me with details and information that I must make sure that her great, great granddaughter learns. Right now, my great niece is 3, and she wouldn't have the capacity to absorb all that this 92-year-old woman is sharing with her family. But the power of what she is sharing is now being held by me. Imagine me being the library. Imagine me being the treasure chest. And my job is to, just like they tell you in church, hide the word in your heart. I have to hide my grandmother's story, my grandmother's truth in my heart so that I can make sure that my niece, her great-great-granddaughter, receives the vital information that will support her survival. That is the power of our story. That is the power of passing these things through the generation. And the point that I made to a friend earlier is that for a great many people, those lines are broken. So we, not only are we revealing it, but we are also healing something. We are healing our ears and healing our voices so that we can hear each other, so that we can talk to one another. We talk about it all the time, the power of communication in any situation, whether it be, you know, inside the community you live in and you're trying to, you know, figure out how to govern yourselves, or at work and you're figuring out how to do a project, in your homes, in your marriages, in your families, you know, how do you go from being good to being great? Or how do we heal? How do we get better after we've hit a huge bump in the road, or after we thought all hope was lost, or, you know, we're about to lose something big and it might not be replaceable? Some of us are dealing with broken lines of communication, and that communication was only meant to aid in our survival. This is important beyond even a Super Tuesday. See, when your lines of communication are not broken, your elders help you inform your present day choices because they tell you about patterns you're not aware of. Mm. They tell you about things that you don't know. When your lines of communication are not broken, your children can come and share with you the things that they're seeing with fresh eyes, and you can help give it definition and structure. It's the same thing. So we're not just conveying and telling. Right now, in real time, we are healing ourselves as well to be able to hear this information and be able to share it as a trusted source.
There's so much I want to say about that. But I guess I'll condense it here. So you mentioned that we haven't been recording a lot during the pandemic. A lot of that is actually on me because I've been depressed a lot of this time. Just because there's a lot going on. People are losing lots of people and stuff like that. And I also shared with our audience that I lost my mom in the beginning of last year. So it's been a two rough years for me. But 2 days ago, I woke up and I was asking myself, like, where's your hope? Like, where is your hope? Don't let them take your hope from you. And so what I determined to do was I said, I'm going to make my mother's pie. My mother makes my favorite sweet potato pie in the world. And I've never made this pie correctly. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to get this right. I'm going to get this right. And I'm going to write this down. The plan is to write this family recipe book of all of our recipes, all of those things that brought our family together, and then write the stories that go along with those recipes. So I made that pie. And for the first time, I got that right. And my whole mood, my whole countenance just changed. And I was like, no, I'm good. Like, hope was renewed. And I was like, yo, I'm just healed by this slice of pie. And then the next three slices of pie after that, because I got it right. So the stories that we tell, the way that we communicate our history and our identity, they are the most important thing that we have. And so it is vital for us, for our survival, to know our stories, to own our stories, to tell our stories. Because as you said, those stories heal us. Those stories correct the wrong stories that are told about us. And so as we move forward in this next chapter after this election, as we write our story, let's make sure that they are our stories. So
might as well.
Next week, we're going to be back with the Brown Liquor Report for a shot and a prayer, where we're going to break down the election, everything leading up to it. Anything happens after that, we're going to be talking about all of it. So we will see you in 1 week for Faith Uncut. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.